Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. How vulnerable is Hawaii's power grid to natural or man-made disasters? How well do you think we as a community could cope without electricity for weeks or months?
Hawaii has more than 80,000 cesspools, and the Surfrider Foundation's Stuart Coleman looks at the reasons we need a regional task force to address the waste disposal and environmental problems they create.
And it's a call for all hands on deck. Unemployment is at an all-time low of 2%, but that means for some businesses is that there's a great need for hired help. We'll tell you where you might have a pretty good chance of getting hired on the spot this week.
And we'll look at the reasons fundamental values of peace and compassion are being taught in the classroom these days through what's called social-emotional learning. It's Monday, March 26th. The conversation starts right after the news.
Here in Hawaii, we're pretty lucky. We only see an occasional power outage that may only last a few hours, but you will have to learn to be patient if a hurricane packing winds of hundreds of miles an hour hit. Many experts agree we're long overdue for a big one. Joining us in studio is Hawaiian Electric Senior Vice President Scott Siu to talk about what's in place to help recover from a disaster and prepare for one. Scott, welcome.
Good morning, Catherine.
So what can you share with us? I heard out of one of these legislative briefings that 60% of Hawaiian Electric's power resources are in like an inundation zone. I mean, how does a company approach, planning for a disaster like that?
Well, inundation zones, first and foremost, they're focused on tsunami, right? Tsunami inundation. But whether it's a tsunami or longer term sea level rise risks, I think it's just an indication that as we rethink how we're planning our electric system and our grid and, for that matter, other critical infrastructure, I think we all need to rethink how we look at where the locations of that infrastructure lie and then take that into our plans. When I'm thinking about threats or natural disasters, I sort of break it into near-term risks and what should we be doing about it. And with things like sea level rise, I would put that into, okay, as we plan our system, as we make those decisions, let's bake that type of a risk into our plans going forward.
Okay, that's long-term.
Right.
And we could, though, be hit with a tsunami, and I think we're getting into the tsunami preparedness, a month, I think, in April, and a lot of resources will be spent talking about that. So we saw what happened in Japan and in Indonesia many years ago. So how does the power utility look at that threat?
Well, I remember a few years ago in one of my prior roles, I was the Hawaiian Electric liaison officer to the state civil defense. This was before they became HAIMA. And I remember during one of the tsunami warnings being down there at the Berkheimer Command Center. And what we were doing with respect to that actual tsunami was first and foremost making sure that our employees were appropriately located. So any one of our facilities, like some of our power plants, they're relatively close to the ocean. We needed to make sure that health and safety of the employees was secured. We also, where we had facilities that weren't critical to keeping the lights on, if we could, then we would tell people, okay, you need to leave. Let's go ahead and move your equipment, move your trucks, and so on further inland. From that, it was really a matter of doing what we could to rebalance where we generate power. So we have power stations that are not on the coast. So if anything, what we would do is we want to look at transitioning power generation to our power plants that are inland and take less of the risk of having some damage to a coastal power plant. So we go through these checkpoints. We also activate what's called our emergency incident management team. And we are there communicating with our employees, with our customers, and, of course, the state emergency response agencies.
Right. And for folks, like I said, who may have been inconvenienced, with the power outage, when we think of long term, as we've seen with some of the storms, we're talking, you can't get gas because, they need electricity, to activate those pumps. You can't charge your phones. I mean, people are really affected when they don't have power.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think all of us, as we look to last year and the experiences, especially that the folks over in Puerto Rico went through with Hurricane Irma, Hurricane Maria, I mean, it was just a sort of an eye-opening experience for everybody, even those of us who have spent many years in the utility sector. One of the things that you can take away is that it's so critical for the different infrastructure owners to be very, very closely coordinated with each other. We rely, for example, on having open roadways and highways to make sure that our crews can get to locations to do repairs. We also, for some of our power plants, we rely on having a source of water to operate those power plants. So you can imagine that if you have a widespread disaster that affects roadways, it affects water supplies, affects communications, that it will be more difficult for the power company to be able to restore its services and provide those the needed electricity.
Right. And you no longer use the facility down there along Ala Moana anymore. But, you know, people know Kahi Power Plant. You know, that's along the coastline there. And if that were to go out, you know, that would affect a lot of people.
It would. We still have power plants in other locations of the island, whether it's Waiau Power Plant in nearby Pearl Harbor or some of the power generating stations in the Campbell Industrial Park. Those actually are not within the normal tsunami inundation zone, so those would be okay from a tsunami, a so-called regular tsunami perspective. You know, as the operator of the electric system, what we would always be looking at is how do we, as quickly as possible, assess what damage there has been, whether it was from a tsunami or hurricane or other event, and very quickly, as rapidly as possible, how do we bring back the power system, understanding that there may be sections of the island which might be without power for longer times.
Right. And I grew up in Guam, which is located in Typhoon Alley, and we've been hit by super typhoons in with winds in excess of 200 miles an hour. And that's devastating. You know, you go months without power. And, you know, when you, if you have a health situation where you rely on electricity for your life-saving equipment, either at home or if you need dialysis, I mean, a lot of those really critical healthcare facilities, you know, there's a big question, like how do you operate?
Right. We communicate very closely with not only our state and county emergency response agencies to prioritize critical facilities like hospitals, you know, certain schools, large, you know, wastewater treatment plants as an example. So we are already aware of those types of facilities that we have to put priority in restoring power to. In the case of hospitals, fortunately, hospitals themselves are required to have certain amounts of emergency power.
Right. They have generators.
That's actually a great lesson for all of our customers. The more that customers themselves can be prepared, it does take pressure off of the electric company. And, you know, because we know that even though you are a very high priority customer, if you can survive, you know, we're coming towards you, we're going to get power back to you, but having that baked-in resilience on our customer's standpoint helps us.
Right. So if you have solar and if you're off the grid, that helps.
It does. I think for us, what we're always trying to look at is, as best as we can, first and foremost, make sure that we have awareness of what the situation is. So in a power outage, you know, assess the damage, come up with a plan on how we fix that, and go from there in terms of coordinating with our customers and the emergency responders. You know, unfortunately, there's going to be situations, I think, where you have areas of the island that, you know, worst case scenario could be without power for you know, on the order of a few weeks. So even more so, we have to make sure that we are aware of what's happening and that our customers on those in those locations are taken care of.
Now, I know in Guam, when they were hit badly one year, I know Hawaiian Electric brought crews in to kind of help in Kukua. You know, and we're so far away. If we really had a big hit, that, you know, would we see that same kind of help, let's say, from the mainland?
We would. We are members of what's called a mutual assistance group. It's a organizations where the electric utility companies on the mainland, and including us here in Hawaii, we are all basically we have pre-agreed upon contracts that we can provide assistance to each other by sending equipment and crews and supplies. So in advance of a storm, for example, we are participating already then in conference calls with our Western Mutual Assistance Group. And everybody is taking stock of the inventory of their supplies and equipment. And basically, we're on call. Once an actual event happens, like a hurricane, at that point, we're making the call to our, you know, colleague utilities on the mainland. Yes, please send equipments. Please send your crews.
Right. So if we had a need for power poles, we would get it.
Right. Right.
Okay.
You know, one of the lessons learned, I think, with Puerto Rico is that it took them so long to make that decision that they needed help from their, you know, fellow utility companies. We would not have that delay here in Hawaii. Again, we're well practiced. We have all the contacts already established with our mainland utility companies, and it's basically a system that goes that kicks into gear even before a storm hits us.
Okay, all right. And as we head into the hurricane season, keep our fingers crossed, and folks just need to be prepared.
Yeah, I think that's probably the immediate message. I think a little bit more going forward, though, is we really need to pull ourselves together with the critical infrastructure owners and our communities to really identify the priorities and the vulnerabilities on our islands and then come up with those right recommendations on what do we do about it.
And we're certainly talking about that now. But thank you, Scott. Thanks for joining us today. Scott Siu is Hawaiian Electric Senior Vice President for Public Affairs. And all this week on The Conversation, we're delving into the vulnerability of Hawaii's infrastructure and vital systems. Tomorrow, the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency covers our Achilles heel, the Port of Honolulu. Are we as prepared as we should be?
People took a personality test that led to the whole Facebook Cambridge Analytica story, right?
I would target you with a strong message about responsibility, about structure.
Now, add me. I'm Kai Rizdal. Personality tests and how they can become a targeting tool. We'll have that story for you and the rest of the day's business news next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Kamea addressing a longtime statewide waste management issue. But first, your quiz. In Hawaii, we know them as hurricanes, but in other parts of the Pacific, the storms are called typhoons, sometimes super typhoons, with winds in excess of 200 miles an hour. But they're all the same tropical storms, just called different things in different regions. The winds pack a punch if they hit landfall, uprooting trees, knocking out power poles, tossing boats and cars, and blowing homes off their foundation. The accompanying torrential rain can bring deadly flooding conditions. We aren't in hurricane season yet, but the deadliest hurricane on record for the U.S. was in 1900. That Galveston hurricane killed close to 12,000 people. It hit Texas with 15-foot storm surges that left the city underwater. But our quiz has to do with what is regarded as the worst storm ever. It hit the Caribbean and Bahamas in the month of October and killed more than 20,000 people. It swamped British and French warships that were lost at sea. The storm hit before technology was developed to track them, but is regarded as the worst storm in the Atlantic and in world history. What we want to know is, what year did this disaster strike? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Nutrex Hawaii, makers of BioAstin and Hawaiian Spirulina, natural microalgae grown in Kailua Kona, committed to environmental stewardship and sustainability. Nutrex-Hawaii.com.
Cesspools are considered antiquated and environmentally hazardous methods of waste disposal. The state is trying to wean Hawaii away from using them, but there's some 88,000 of them here, releasing 53 million gallons of untreated sewage into the ground each day. A resolution currently in play at the State House calls for the creation of a regional task force in each county to look into the feasibility and potential impacts of cesspool replacement. The Surfrider Foundation has been working on the issue for years. Stuart Coleman is its Hawaii coordinator, and he's with us in our studio. Hi, Stuart.
Hey, good morning.
Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
As you came in this morning, you were monitoring activity at the legislature on this very issue. What's going on now?
Yes, it's always something in play at the legislature.
Right.
You never know exactly what's going to happen, but we have two bills right now that are still in play. One is House Bill 2626 that creates a cesspool working group, and the other is Senate Bill 2567 that was originally supported the conversion from a cesspool to either a septic system or an aerobic treatment unit upon conversion of sale within $180, because that's when there's a lot of money going back and forth.
Right.
But apparently it's now being the real estate lobby is very powerful, and so they've shaped it into a kind of bill that would do create a task force to come up with a solution to the problem.
Well, the problem has been hanging fire for quite some time and is not going to go away. So what do you regard as a viable way to address it?
Well, originally we worked with the Department of Health and helped create a bill, Act 120, that was signed into law, and it created a $10,000 tax credit for people to convert their cesspools and to upgrade them. And originally it was 200 feet from a body of water. That's, you know, if you were eligible, you had to be within that. And then we expanded it to 400 feet, and that's like either a well, the ocean, a river, or an aquifer. And so that was good, but we still found that people weren't doing the conversions because, you know, for low-income folks, that's still tough. You know, they don't need a $10,000 tax credit, and we were trying to pool it like the solar companies did, so the companies themselves could take the tax breaks and help low-income people do it and help people make that. So that didn't work, but the good news is we were able to pass a mandatory conversion by 2050, so we have that kind of goal, but we need to do something a lot sooner than then.
What's the difference between a cesspool and a septic tank? What is a conversion?
Yeah.
Let me ask that first.
A cesspool is the most basic, rudimentary kind
of— hole in the ground.
It's just a hole in the ground, exactly.
Yeah.
And the waste is pumped into there. There's no real treatment. There's no leach field. There's no lining. And so when it rains, and we have places— in heavy rainfall areas like Kahalu, which is a priority one area that has been deemed, you know, a target area that for the earliest conversions, that stuff will just leach out all over the place. So a septic system is one that's lined inside, so solids settle to the bottom, and there's a lot of kind of aerobic treatment going on there, and then there's a leach field where if it comes out, it can still percolate into the ground, and it has a time to kind of be processed more. Now, there's still that's still problematic in areas where you have heavy rainfalls like we've been having lately.
Because they can overflow?
Exactly. And so even then, but a septic system is always better than a cesspool. But some people are saying we should also do aerobic treatment units, which takes it one step higher and kind of makes sure that it's treated before it comes out into the leach field. And so there's a higher level of treatment. And then sewer lines are the best.
Each time you move to a higher level of treatment, you add to the cost for a homeowner who might just be getting by and not able to afford the simplest conversion. What would a cesspool to septic tank conversion cost for, say, a small home?
Right. It varies anywhere from between, I've heard estimates of like $12,000-$14,000 up to, if you get a really, really good unit, $25,000, at the top end.
Serious stuff, though.
Yeah, serious money. And that's why Gabbard's bill, the Senate bill 2567 was good, because when you're in the sale, that's when there's money. And there's, an extra $25,000 to improve something that's going to improve public health and the value of the property, mm-hmm. We thought was a really good idea. Mm-hmm. But it's still, the good news is it's still moving forward. It already passed the House, already passed the Senate, is in the House side, and it's going to finance. So we just want to make sure that it gets a hearing in finance.
It still would seem that for a low-income homeowner mm-hmm. who is basically just getting by and just doesn't have $20,000 for anything, they're going to wait till 2050.
Yeah. So what we were trying to do, Surfrider worked with an alliance of different groups and scientists and researchers and government folks to create the Hawaii Reef and Ocean Coalition. Mm-hmm. And we had a suite of bills that were our target, and cesspools were at the top of that list, and then polystyrene foam and other bills that are oxybenzone that are damaging to the reefs and our ocean and mm-hmm. our economy, obviously, because of tourism. And so we kind of talked about early on having a model where the blatant offenders who've been warned and said your cesspools are inadequate, where you create a system of fines. If you're violating the law, you create the fines, and then you could create a pool of money that would go into a pool to help low-income mm-hmm. folks do that. And so it's kind of punishing the bad actors and helping the people who need the help. So I imagine something like that will be in the future. But then again, the state is going to – and the counties are going to have to work together to set aside money for this, because it's going to be quite expensive.
It generally takes a certain amount of national attention to take an issue like this and get some movement on it.
Yeah.
Fair to say?
Yeah. I got a call from the Wall Street Journal, and I was surprised. I was like, okay, this is a national news item now, and mm-hmm. that's not the kind of publicity that Hawaii needs.
Right.
And so I think that is the kind of pressure. And also DOH did a study, and they decided of the 88,000 they prioritized in three tiers. Tier one being the highest kind of contamination, and that's like Kahalu and upcountry Maui, and those are the ones we have to work on right away, because mm-hmm. it could be a threat to the water supply.
Just because there's so many of them within a small area.
There's so many of them, and there it's a low lying area, and there's we're talking about sea level rise and places where we've been having these torrential rains. That's leading to very contaminated waters.
The wastewater situation in Hawaii is far from ideal anyway, right?
Right.
We're constantly dumping waste into the ocean after virtually every heavy rain. You can expect to see a headline a couple of days later, right?
Yeah. That's the highest level. The greatest source of water pollution is just stormwater runoff, because our storm drains run right into the ocean. And so we've created a program called Ocean Friendly Gardens, just trying to get people to realize there's simple things that we can do and the counties and the state can do on the highways and everything to reduce that runoff, because that's the number one pollutant. And they're just common sense, best management practices that we can all incorporate.
Well, environmental pollution in Hawaii that's just not a good mix.
It's not, especially when tourism is your number one economic engine.
Someday we'll all figure this out. Thanks very much, Stuart.
My pleasure.
Stuart Coleman is the Surfrider Foundation's Hawaii coordinator.
Hi, I'm Elia Bruno from HNO2 Library. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on the HPR mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
Kidney transplants are desperately needed and can be life-saving for those who have kidney failure. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me next time on The Body Show. We'll talk with a local transplant surgeon about the process of receiving and giving a kidney to someone you love. That's Monday at 6:30 on The Body Show.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, presenting the music of Led Zeppelin, featuring songs Kashmir, Stairway to Heaven, and more, 7:30 p.m. this Saturday at the Blaisdell, hisymphony.org.
The military is one of the largest employers here in the islands. It takes a lot to support its mission with installations across the state. That's why come Wednesday, these jobs will be front and center at a career fair at the Neil Blaisdell Center. Joining us in studio this morning is Sean Morrissey with Navy Region Hawaii to tell us what kinds of positions it's looking to fill. Morning.
Good morning. Thank you. And I'm pleased to be here.
So tell us, how many positions are you looking to fill at Navy Region?
Well, for Navy Region Hawaii itself, we're looking at over 100 positions. We've got 50 security guard positions that we'll be filling, 13 security administrative assistant positions, 5 emergency vehicle dispatcher positions, and 17 firefighter positions. And in addition to Navy Region Hawaii, the Naval Facilities Engineering Command will be there looking to hire over 100 personnel. And in addition, the non-appropriated fund activity, people that do housing and those things will be there as well looking.
Now, unemployment is at an all-time low. You folks apparently are prepared to offer people jobs on the spot.
That's correct. That's one thing that's different this year. We've gotten a new authority called Direct Hire Authority, under which we can actually, at the fair itself, at the expo, offer a tentative job offer to somebody, and then provided they meet the requirements after that with the screening things that we do, we bring them on board.
So this is unusual. You just have a great need, and you need to start putting people to work right away.
Oh, yes, ma'am. And you know, the wonderful thing is this Direct Hire Authority has given us the ability now to fill some of those vacancies that typically, through the normal process, it takes quite a while to bring somebody on board. We would hope, using our Direct Hire Authority, that we would be bringing people on board within 30 to 60 days of the job fair, getting through those requirements and actually bringing them on board.
So tell us, what should people expect when they come to this expo on Wednesday, if you're prepared to make them offers?
What I was going to say is the first thing they should do is make sure they update the resume and they have a good resume that speaks to their educational experiences, any work experience they have. Because one of the things we'll be doing there is we'll have qualifiers from the HR, the Human Resources Service Center there, which will actually qualify them on the spot based on the resumes. They should be prepared for an interview because we'll have interviewers there. We'll do the interview. And then based on the outcome of that qualification and the interviews, we'll be making those job offers right there at the fair. With the exception of the firefighters, the firefighter position, we'll be taking those resumes in, and then we'll be doing some scoring and interviews the following week.
And so what's the pitch? Because you folks aren't the only ones at this job fair. You know, you've got folks from private sector, other military branches, and government as well.
Yeah, we recognize there's a lot of competition out there and a pretty tight job market right now. But you know, the federal government's we've got competitive pay, we've got a wonderful benefits package, and once you're in federal employment, it does open some doors for other federal jobs. And those sometimes you know positions are limited to people that are already part of federal workforce. And the other thing I'd say is it's it's a wonderful job. You're doing something that that supports the nation's Navy, and that's a very rewarding position to be in.
And these are all full-time positions, no part-time?
They're all full-time, no part-time positions. These are all full-time positions.
So you should come mentally prepared, ready to work. And, you know, if you're, let's say, in one career and trying to make a jump to something else, to try something new, you know, this might be the opportunity.
Oh, it'd be an excellent opportunity. The other thing is of course, the firefighters, our security guards, and our vehicle dispatchers also are shift work positions. So some people have things where they may desire something where they potentially could be working in the evening or a different shift that accommodates something with respect to their family life and those things. So, you know, that's another opportunity for somebody that might be looking for something, not just a 9-to-5 job.
Now, I know security guards are in high demand, you know, even on the outside. Lots of training and licensing requirements that have changed over the years. What makes it different for the military?
Well, our security guards, I think, you know, the first thing is we've got a top-notch training program. Our security guards, once they've come on board, we put them through a 5-week relatively intense training program. And then they're part of the blended security force we have that has civil servant, Air Force, and Navy defenders that are part of that that overall force protection that we provide. So you get to work with those the active duty military personnel, and it's just an exciting thing. I think that's what we can offer.
Is there anything that participants might do to prepare then for Wednesday? There's something on the website that they can go to that, you know, talks about the requirements for some of these jobs?
I'm not sure what's on the website right now, but I can tell you that for the security guard and the firefighter positions, they all have to go through a drug screening. They all go through a 2-part medical exam. And they will have a physical agility test, so you do have to be somewhat fit for that. And then they'll have a security clearance for those positions. For emergency vehicle dispatchers, they'll have a medical exam and then a security clearance. And for our admin assistants, they have to have a security clearance.
But the special authority that you have to hire on the spot, I mean, this basically fast-tracks folks where they might wait maybe, I don't know, a couple of months to get hired, that wait time is significantly shortened.
Absolutely. In the past, for us to bring a security guard on board or any of these positions, it could be 6 to 9 months or sometimes even longer. With this, that ability to actually make the job offer there to somebody, have them qualified, interviewed, make a job offer, we can bring them in the following week and we start all that processing, those medical exams and those things. And so it significantly reduces the time from when somebody would apply to when they're actually brought on board.
And then do some folks then get special privileges on base, use of the facilities, the PX? How does that work?
There are some things that they're allowed. They use our the fitness facilities and those things. Typically, the PX and the commissary is not one of those privileges they would get. But being able to use some of the MWR facilities on the base and
MWR,
that, morale, welfare, and recreation, the restaurants and those things is one of the benefits that would go with that.
Okay, one of the perks of the job.
Yeah.
Trying to think now, in areas, let's say, where you have jobs that are hard to fill, have there been instances where then you recruit from other states, other territories?
Yeah, we've done that in the past. In fact, our most some of our recent guard hirings and firefighter recruitments, we actually go out worldwide and we pick up a number of people that apply off of the mainland for those positions as well, and then go through that normal processing. But that's part of what ends up making it take 6 to 9 months frequently for somebody to get on board.
Right. So your first preference is to hire locally.
Oh, yeah, we love to hire locally if we can, and this direct hire authority has given us the ability to do that. And we know when we hire locally, we have somebody who's here. They, you know, typically are going to be with us for a longer period of time. They understand the islands, and they like it here.
All right. So, well, job fairs maybe weren't part of the picture before. This year they are, and hopefully you get a good turnout on Wednesday.
Thank you. Yeah, we had the 31st of January we did was really the first one we've done with this style. There were a lot of applicants there, and as I said, it's already yielded. The first people are actually on board coming off of that job fair we did.
All right. Well, good luck on Wednesday. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
That was Sean Morrissey, the Deputy Operations Officer for Navy Region Hawaii. The Hawaii Career Expo will be held at the Neil Blaisdell Center March 28th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m.
Aloha, I'm Ruth Fletcher from St. Andrew's Schools. We represent the Priory, the Prep, and Queen Emma Preschool. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at the massive universe around our tiny planet and what we can look for in our dark island skies. As usual, we're turning to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. Welcome back, Christopher. What do you have in store for us this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for the giant of the solar system, Jupiter, as it rises in the west shortly after 9:45 p.m. Now, the moon this week will be passing through its full moon phase, so spotting those faint satellites and meteors is going to be tricky.
You have an update for us this week on a story relating to mysterious radio signal bursts.
Yes, it's fast radio bursts, or FRBs for short. And they're basically what they say on the tin. They are extremely short, rapid bursts of energy that appear brightest in the radio part of the spectrum. Now, FRBs have been keeping some of us astronomers up at night because we have no idea what's causing them.
Has this been keeping you up at night, Christopher?
Indeed it has.
And is the reason it's keeping some astronomers up at night because they think it might have something to do with extraterrestrials?
Well, that's a long shot, a very, very long shot. In fact, I'm willing to bet that what we are seeing is purely natural in origin. Now, what's weird about them is that they last only a few milliseconds. They pop into existence and then rapidly fade away, leaving no trace. Very strange indeed.
And how could that be natural?
It certainly does sound weird, doesn't it? Now, we normally associate bursts of radio waves with energetic events like supernovae or colliding neutron stars or the cores of active galaxies. But these FRBs don't seem to have any visual companions to allow us to see what's going on.
What do you think is really going on?
I honestly have no idea. But whatever they are immensely powerful. And anything that happens to be close to one of these things is going to be barbecued.
And it's not like they're coming in patterns that if you studied it, it would be like Morse code or something.
No, they're completely random. In fact, we've only ever found one that seems to repeat itself, but even that repeats randomly.
If and when we hear the big news that this was some colossal discovery, we'll remember this moment in time. It'll be the moment we first heard about the mysterious
FRBs.
Christopher Phillips and another fun-filled and mysterious Stargazer report. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Urgent Care Hawaii, walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki, providing employers with occupational medicine and workers' compensation services. AmazingUrgentCare.com.
In today's backyard quiz, we put the spotlight on typhoons and hurricanes. We were looking for the worst storm on record for the entire globe. It hit Barbados in the Caribbean, killing more than 20,000 people in its path. The winds that hit Barbados were estimated about 200 miles per hour. It hit the islands as the American Revolution was raging to the north, and both English and French warships fighting for control of Caribbean waters were damaged in the storm. For years, it was simply known as the Great Hurricane, and that hurricane season in 1780 was remembered as one of the worst ever. If you were first to answer Great Hurricane of the Antilles, Hurricane San Calixto, or Great Hurricane of the Antilles in 1780, you are our winner.
And Carla Hart of Kihei, Maui, is exactly that. Congratulations, Carla. You're our winner, and that's our quiz for today. If you've got one for us, you can send it to TalkBack@HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, helping to prepare students for the SBA exam with topical content and practice for the types of questions found on the test. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
It's impossible to look at the rash of school shootings and the prevalence of bullying in our schools without wondering if the nation's social fabric hasn't been torn and fundamental human values eroded. Social and emotional learning, or SEL, is a new term of art in today's educational community. It describes a set of programs aimed at repairing the social fabric by teaching compassion and encouraging healthy social interaction. Robbie Ancone is the Director of Programs for Omidyar Initiatives at the Hawaii Community Foundation, which provides funding for SEL programs in 21 schools in Hawaii.
There's really nothing new about social-emotional learning. I think it's a renewed emphasis on the importance of paying attention to the whole child, not just their academic performance, but also their social-emotional health. When we talk about SEL programs, we're looking at things according to there's a collaboration of academic and social-emotional learning that looks at SEL, has a framework around it, has SEL competencies that they are aiming for the students. And these skills are around things like self-awareness, really emotional intelligence. How do you know how you feel? Can you put a label to it? Self-management, are you able to regulate those emotions appropriately? Social awareness, are you able to recognize emotions in other people? If you look at someone and you see their reaction, do you understand what they're feeling or what their emotions are? Which then helps you to build those relationships with other people. If you have compassion, if you have empathy, you can care about other people. And then, which of course leads to better responsible decision-making, goal-setting, that sort of behavior.
How did society get to the point where looking somebody in the eye, being honest, and listening to what somebody else says has to be taught?
I'm not sure I know the answer to that. I do think that part of it probably has to do with technology today. I look at my own child and I see them on their phone, watching TV, on their computer screen, playing games, but not always interacting with people as much. You really need to have the skills of looking at somebody or even understanding the emotion within your own body and understanding and labeling that emotion to be able to regulate it and know what's at the root cause of those feelings.
Well, the rise of cyberbullying, for example, has meant that the kind of mean impulses that we might have experienced ourselves as kids on the playground now can be transmitted to a much wider audience. And you know, but aside from the technology that allows bullying to be done that way, there's the spirit that leads to it.
Right. And I think with cyberbullying, there's also an issue of anonymity. Right? You can post things and people aren't always sure who did it. And so you can be mean to someone and say something not very nice and not actually get blamed for it. There's also that reach that technology has and that inability to delete that from space, you know, forever, that I think has become, made the bullying issue more intense.
How did it become such a source of pleasure to anonymously be mean to someone?
I don't know that I can say I actually know the answer to that, but I think a strong piece of that can be helped by these social and emotional learning programs. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think about if you understand what someone else is feeling, if you have compassion and empathy for them, mm-hmm. you're less likely to do those things, right? I mean, Scarlett Lewis, who is the founder of one of our SEL programs that our schools is using, the Choose Love Enrichment Program. The Choose Love Enrichment Program. So mm-hmm. she talks about, you know, if you choose love, if you have compassion for someone else, you wouldn't do mean things to them, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, I wonder sometimes about the sort of thicket of terms of edu-speak language that kind of cloaks, humanity, basic humanity.
I mean,
do we gain that much by giving a new vocabulary to these ideas?
I think I mean, as we were talking, this is not new, right? This being aware and understanding your emotions is not new. But I think we need this reminder certain times. I think that for some of our young people, they've experienced so much trauma in their lives that they do need a reminder. They do need to be taught some of these skills. One of our programs, other programs we do, is called Roots of Empathy. And that program actually works to teach empathy in young people, and that it is something that you can teach. It is something that you can build in our young students.
Well, you know, I'm hearing in my imagination the voice of a listener saying, where are the parents in all this?
Yes.
Right? These are parental responsibilities, aren't they?
In a way, yes, they are. But we also have parents that are working two jobs and aren't always home with the children. I think there are certain conditions in society that have gotten us to this point. And SEL programs in the schools, you know, we don't want to burden our teachers with one more thing to do, certainly. But they are finding that they are helpful in the classrooms, that they are helping the children to learn the skills they need to have in life to be successful in their career. Mm-hmm. And they are helping in the classroom. You know, they're reducing negative behaviors. They are increasing and improving focus for some of the students, depending on what programs they're doing.
Let me just read you the names of some. I know you're familiar with these names. I'm just seeing how SEL is social and emotional learning is broken down. You have No Bully, Philosophy for Children, Positive Discipline, Roots of Empathy. This seem to have broken down into a lot of very specific categories.
There are many different SEL programs. They range everywhere from ones that are more about how you talk about issues in the class, kind of procedures, to super intense new content that's delivered into a classroom. Mm-hmm. There are free programs. There are programs that are fairly expensive. There are programs that go right to the students, and there are programs that really require all the adults to get taught first, that the adults need emotional intelligence and understanding as well so they can model the behavior for the children. So there are many, many different SEL programs out there. Many of them tested with a lot of research that shows that they do what they intend to do. So with the Roots of Empathy, they really are looking at empathy as the trait they're trying to develop. So what we're finding for the Hoy Community Foundation is that what's important is the fit for the schools. So schools start at so many different points. They have different issues and challenges they're facing. They have different demographics in their school community.
Right.
And they have different goals, right, for their students. And so the value of what we're trying to do right now with our SEL cohort is to try to learn which ones work for which kinds of schools and be able to share that information with other people.
So suppose a parent or teacher or school administrator hearing this says, hey, my school or my kid could use a little bit of this. What should their next step be?
I would check first if the school is doing anything, because a lot of times the schools are already doing a program. At the Community Foundation, we're actually funding 11 schools in a cohort. The 11 schools are using 25 different tools, so they sometimes layer them on each other, or they use different programs for different grade levels.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of schools that are doing things that are not part of our cohort, that are not being funded by us. So I would check first if the school is having a program already. I might share information with my school if they aren't doing an SEL program. There are a lot of resources available through our Pillars of Peace Hawaii website, through the CASEL, which is CASEL, the Collaborative for Academic and Social-Emotional Learning.org website. A lot of resources out there that they can share with their school faculty to let them know that this is something important.
Robbie Ann Kane is the Director of Programs for Omidyar Initiatives at the Hawaii Community Foundation. She leads Pillars of Peace Hawaii, which is a Hawaii Community Foundation initiative. It provides funding for social and emotional learning programs in 21 schools in Hawaii.
if you're not under the weather and you've got some free time. There's a lot going on around town to take advantage of. Morning Edition host Derek Malama joins us for a look at some of the events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar.
Yes.
So I understand we were talking water usage in Honolulu. What's that about?
Well, there is a community meeting tomorrow. The Board of Water Supply is developing a watershed management plan for Oahu's urban center. And that area stretches from Kaimuki to Pearl City. That's a large area there. This meeting will present information on current and future water usage. So you can share your questions and concerns tomorrow at 7 p.m. And this meeting is taking place in Kapalama Elementary in Kalihi.
I wonder if they're going to be talking water rates, too.
Maybe.
Tune in, right?
Yes.
And tomorrow in Kona, a book club discusses a New York Times bestseller from last year. What's that about?
The Lost City of the Monkey God is the true story of author Douglas Preston, who back in 2012 joined a team of explorers searching for the White City, that's a legendary ruin in the jungles of eastern Honduras. So if you read the book, you know what happened. So please go to the Kona Stories bookstore tomorrow to talk about it with others and bring a poo-poo to share as well. The Nonfiction Book Club meets at 6 p.m. on Tuesday at the Kona Stories bookstore.
And Kumukahua Theater hosts a reading of a new script tonight and tomorrow.
It's for a play called Memorial Day, about a doctor in the early days of the AIDS crisis. The play is described as a serious yet humorous look at the pain of being unable to help. Memorial Day is tonight and tomorrow at 7:30 in Kumukahua. Admission's free, but you should reserve a seat and just head to our website for more information.
All right. Thanks, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at some of the events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
This week's On the Media, Mark Zuckerberg sounded contrite after being caught red-handed giving away Facebook users' data, promising that
if we detect any suspicious activity, we're going to do a full forensic audit and make sure that no one out there is improperly using data.
Uh-huh. Heard that before. Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC.
This evening at 7.
We have to go, but join us all this week as we look into the vulnerability of Hawaii's infrastructure and vital systems. Up tomorrow, David Lopez with the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency.
We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, post comments on Facebook at The Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation.
If you missed any of this show or want a previous one, check the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.